out of it is being transmitted from the interrogator to the RFID tag. The RFID tag picks up a sample of that signal, rectifies it, it charges a capacitor. The capacitor becomes a temporary battery that runs the integrated circuit chip that's on the tag, and the tag then talks back on the exact same frequency by modulating its impedance, changing the reflectivity of that antenna in the air the signal is getting to it. The interrogator is transmitting at, let's say, 915 megs, listening at exactly 915 megacycles to the signal coming back from the tag, which is usually 70 decibels weaker. So how are you getting 70 decibels of suppression on the F1, F1 frequency between transmit and receive? Let me drop. That was being done by a combination. Number one, you first make sure that your transmitting antenna on the RFID reader has an extremely low standing wave ratio, 20, 25, and 30 dB of reflected signal suppression because of low visual on the antenna. That's part of it. Second of all, you've got a directional coupler that's sampling only the signal coming back to the receiver, not the signal going out. You've got high directivity in that coupler. And the third step is you've got cancellation circuits on board that take a sample of your own transmitter, feed it back 180 degrees out of phase with the right amplitude in the receiver to suppress your own transmitter at the receiver without suppressing the signal coming back from the tag, which has a modulated signal on it. You don't suppress the modulation, you only suppress the CW component of it, so to speak. So every RFID reader is a CW radar, transmitting and receiving on the exact same frequency simultaneously. So to that degree, they're already doing it. I wonder if you were aware of that, Jonathan. KC2SHO, K2IW in the TechNet. As I said, I was working in that business for 10 years.
Well, I guess K2IW, KC2SHO, I guess it's something I hadn't thought much about, but I guess radar works in a similar way, although maybe they turn it off waiting for the return. Maybe you could explain more about that, but if that's true, then why are you claiming that we may still need to employ a mixture of both technologies, the physical filter and the self-cancellation technology? Maybe perhaps I'm missing something here. Please explain further, K2RIW, KC2SHO.
I'm anticipating you would do both, depending on the number of decibels of suppression you desire. If you only desire 40 dB of suppression, either technique will work like a charm. If you desire 70 and 80 dB of suppression, either technique becomes very expensive to get that high a resolution, is my belief. Therefore, a combination of the two, where each is now using only medium technology, which is not so expensive, a combination of two, I am guessing, would be the right approach if you want a whole lot of suppression. And when it comes to normal radar does a 1 or 10 microsecond transmission. The transmission is completely turned off, and I mean completely turned off. Hopefully it's something like a magnetron for the final stage, and you remove all B-plus from the final stage so it's not making noise. Just having a transmitter running continuously and you change the excitation to it is not good enough, because the transmitter is just sitting there making noise. But our normal radar transmits a brief pulse, and then for the next few milliseconds, it does reception with no transmitter present. So it is alternating transmitting and receiving in the time domain. Let me drop. But in the military world, there is something called a CW radar. When it comes to the surface-to-air missile hardware, the CW transmitter on the ground is lighting up the skin of the aircraft that's the target, and it's simultaneously receiving that echo in order to, by the monopulse technique, properly aim that antenna to know which direction to aim the signal and to know which direction to send the missile. The way that's frequently achieved is to have two microwave parabolic dishes side by side. One does the transmitting, one does the reception. And so that alone, the two separate dishes side by side, properly set up mechanically, gives you, let me pick a number, 60 decibels of suppression. And the additional suppression is done by electronic techniques, so that you can receive the exact same signal being transmitted from the aircraft, and you have to do that during the time the aircraft is flying parallel to the path between you and it, where there's no Doppler shift. Hopefully the aircraft, the target is flying away from you or toward you, and the Doppler shift means that the receive frequency is different than the transmit frequency, and things become a little bit easier. But CW radar that transmits and receives on the exact same signal simultaneously has existed for a lot of years, and with difficulty, it is achievable. Does that make some sense, Jonathan? KC2SHO, K2RIW in the TechNet. A good subject you brought up. You still there, Jonathan? You made a brief transmission of one word where the noise wasn't on your transmitter, and then you stopped transmitting entirely.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. That wasn't me. That was somebody else there, and I'm getting some interference that's causing the IRIP node to transmit all the time. Let me make sure I got it. Looks like I've captured it again. Okay. Yeah, it makes perfect sense, and yeah, it is a fascinating subject. I'm still curious, though, why this works so well. What they're claiming in the article is that they're able to deploy handhelds, vehicles, and base stations that all work in this ad hoc environment. All of them are able to transmit, receive, and be repeaters for this ad hoc network at the same time due to this technology. So I wonder how far we are away from seeing single frequency ham radio repeaters and this type of thing 10 years, 20 years before it's cheap enough for the hobby. I don't know. But it promotes a lot of interesting concepts and ideas, and I wonder how fast things will move, or if we'll see it here, or playouts will see it. They're already saying within a few years we'll see within our home Wi-Fi networks to improve bandwidth and spectrum efficiency. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Yeah, how soon will ham radio and repeaters be using it is an interesting question. The biggest problem is selling the idea. A high percentage of the amateurs who could use it won't believe it. So it's going to have a slow start, I think. The technology has been there for 2 decades, and as you can tell, nobody except Sam Harris way back in the late 70s has really used it that I know of. And there's probably a few others that we haven't heard about. So selling it is going to be difficult. This West Coast company that was owned by AIL that was selling this product, when that was first explained to many of the engineers on our side of the country, they started off saying, that's a tall tale, I don't believe it. It took a lot of convincing of modern-day engineers to convince them that it's a reality. So you got the skepticism problem to get past. Okay, I've described the RFID readers. Okay, it's a good subject, and you can bring it up again. There was another person who had an antenna question. Whiskey Alpha 2 Mike Yankee Lima, was it? Mike Hotel Lima. Ask her, whichever it was. Please give us, correct me on your call letters. Please tell me your name, and then proceed with your question. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
2MHL, the name is Bob. I have an antenna question. Is there a coupler made that I can have my one antenna on the roof, have it come down in the closet, and then have a piece of coax go out to the one radio and another piece of coax go down the hall so that I can attach to it an HT at night?
Yeah, you didn't wait for the beeps, huh? You're lucky you didn't time it out, Bob. What some people have done is to have a transmission line come down from the antenna on the roof, and at various places along the transmission line, you have a BNCT connector. And by connecting If the line goes all the way to the shack, to the main rig, and periodically when you're interested, say for instance the line runs by the living room, you open up the T connector and connect your handy talkie or whatever else you want to at that particular time. So you can make a poor man's switching network by having connectors placed along a transmission line that you can open up, or using them as a T connector itself. Of course, you want to open up the cable going to the receiver in the shack to make sure you don't overload its front end with your transmitter. Many people believe that the transmission line coming down from the antenna must be thoroughly uninterrupted and go straight to the rig, otherwise you get extra insertion loss. People believe that each individual BNC connector, UHF connector, N connector has half a dB of insertion loss. People believe that hogwash. Pure bull. Absolutely not. You can prove that to yourself very easily. Let me drop. You can take your 100-watt transmitter, and right at the transmitter, make it go through a pair of female and a male connector of any sex connector you like, UHF, BNC, type N. In other words, by a female-to-female adapter and type N and male transmitting, male connectors. You can create a connector combination right at the transmitter, going to your transmission line that goes to the antenna. You transmit 100 watts through that combination for the next 5 minutes. Put your hand on that combination of connectors. At the 100 watt level, you might not be able to feel the heat, and if you do feel the heat, it'll be mildly perceptible. Maybe 1 watt of heat is taking place in those connectors, depending on the quality of the connector you're using. And the heat that you're feeling is only due to a cheaply made connector that's got a lousy dielectric constant in the center of it. And even that connector might have been used at the end of your normal transmission line going into the transmitter, if you know what I mean. 1 watt of dissipation due to the heat that you feel out of 100 watts of transmitted is something like a 0.01 dB of insertion loss. Real connectors have no length. As long as they're made out of good materials, they have no loss. Everybody believes they do. It's just an old wives' tale. Or because the connector is improperly installed and there's some standing wave ratio, you'll measure what you think is an insertion loss. So you can put as many adapters as you want along your transmission line and easily tap into it. Can you put a directional coupler? Let me drop. Can you put a directional coupler up at the antenna and run two transmission lines down? Absolutely. But now you're going to obey the law of conservation of energy. If you're taking the signal from the antenna and splitting it into two separate signals going down to two separate rigs, you're going to get half the power to each. That's a 3 dB insertion loss. There's no way that you can make... Oh, I take it back. No. With a directional coupler, a 20 dB directional coupler, and an amplifier, you can make both signals equal. No, even with the amplifier, you're not going to be able to transmit back. So any kind of a coupler going down to two transmission lines is going to create an insertion loss that you might not be happy with. Wonder what you see what I'm saying here, Bob. WA to Motet, Mike Hotel Lima. Wait for the beeps. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. Thank you very much. Yes, I understand what you're saying. And basically, you're telling me I can do what I'm trying to do. I haven't tried it yet, but now I'll run a coax from my bedroom into my office. This is WA2MHL. My name is Bob. Thank you. 73s.
Now, you said you're going to do it. I don't know what that means. You are going to put a coupler at the antenna, or you're going to run the antenna from station, you're going to run the transmission line from station one location, past station two location, and then up to the antenna. And then by opening up the connectors, you can tap into it and use either one of those rigs with no extra insertion loss. Is that what you're saying, Bob? Over to you, Bob.
Yes, Dick, that's correct. I'm going to do it the second way, not the first way. I'm not going to run all the way up to the antenna again.
Yeah, that's what I recommend. Any method of dividing the signal from the antenna into two separate receivers is going to create insertion loss. There's no getting around that, the laws of physics, conservation of energy, if you know what I mean. The only other approach would be two transmission lines coming down, if you want, with an electronically operatable switch at the antenna. And you can decide by way of that single pole, double throw switch, which line is active. That's another approach, which in theory would not create insertion loss. Okay, we've answered all the questions of the people who signed in, I believe. Yes. This beautiful letter that Dr. Roy received from AA2IT, Joe, asked a very interesting set of questions. And I'm going to give my particular approach to it, and Roy's going to give his approach to it. Let me drop a quick. The general gist of the question is on the subject of free space loss. It's one way of looking at it. Let me try to explain what that means. If I had a 100-watt light bulb, which I consider it to be a isotropic radiator, it radiates light in all directions. An incandescent light bulb is really transmitting 100 watts of light. And if I put it into a spherical room, center of the spherical room, that's 5.8 meters in diameter. The area of that room, that spherical room, is 100 square meters. 100 watt light bulb, isotropic radiation, 100 square meters of receiving area, the walls of the spherical room. Each square meter is going to get 1 watt of energy. And whether the light bulb is operating at the infrared, optical, or ultraviolet frequencies, doesn't matter. As long as 100 watts is coming out of this isotropic light bulb, each square meter of that room is going to get 1 watt of energy hitting it. That's what isotropic is like. Okay. Now, I'm going to jump subject temporarily, and you're going to see why in a minute. Let me drop. If I took all the smartest amateurs at any group of amateurs I know of, a VHF, UHF microwave group, a repeater group, any group of amateurs, and I ask them a very simple, direct question. I've got a dipole antenna on the transmitter. I've got a dipole antenna on the receiver. I'm operating at 100 megacycles, and there's 1 mile of distance between the two. If I transmit a 1 watt signal out of the first antenna, assume there's no multipath, there's no ground reflection, there's no other buildings or whatever, there's nothing but free space. 1 mile away, how strong will the reception signal be in the other antenna? I think 98% of the amateurs cannot easily answer that question. So the amount of signal that's lost in free space is a little bit mysterious. You can solve the question exactly by using the so-called radar range equation, which has got about 10 terms to it. You plug in all the numbers and you come up with an answer. It's an easier approach. To a significant number of people who have listened to the TechNet over the years, I've given them this very simplified formula for free space loss. The amount of loss of free space is the following formula in decibels. Let me drop. dB of loss in free space equals 36.6 plus 20 times the log of F plus 20 times the log of D. F is frequency in megahertz, D is distance in miles. You plug in the frequency in megahertz, the distance in miles, to that relatively simple formula, and you come up with an exact number for free space loss. I'll give you an example. 1 mile of distance, 100 megahertz of frequency. What's the loss? 100 megacycles, the log of it to the base 10 is 2. There's a 20 in front, 2 times 20 is 40. 1 mile, the log of 1 is 0. So the second term drops out. So 36.6 plus the 40 is 76.6. So at 100 megacycles, 1 mile of distance gives you exactly 76.6 decibels of free space loss. Next question is, where's the loss really happening? Free space. If I now put all of that inside of a big chamber and I make careful measurements, is the air getting hot? Is the 76 dB of loss occurring in the air? The answer is no. And I'll give you a second example and make it a little bit more clear. Let me drop it. I first do the experiment at 100 megacycles, and I said I was using a dipole on each end, 76.6 dB of insertion loss. The transmitting dipole's got 2 dB of gain, The receiving dipole has got 2 dB of gain. I take the 4 dB away from 76.6, and I end up with 72.6. So 72.6 dB weaker will be the signal at the receiving site compared to the signal at the transmitting site. 1 watt of transmitter plus 30 dBm. I subtract the 30 from the 72, and I end up with minus 42, I think it is. So minus 42 dBm will be the reception if I did the math right. So you can predict how strong the signal will be if it was free space. Now you know there's really going to be some trees in between. There's going to be some ground reflection. So you add some other number of decibels, maybe 5, 10, 15 decibels of ambiguity because of ground reflection, in phase, out of phase, and so on. But at least the majority of the reception you can calculate ahead of time and then add a fudge factor to it to bring it into the ballpark. Let me drop. So I was doing that experiment at 100 megacycles. What happens if I go to 200 megacycles? Plugging it into the formula, you're going to get 6 dB of additional loss. The 76 6 dB becomes 82.6 dB if I go at 200 megacycles. Where did the extra loss come from? The transmitting antenna, remember the light bulb in the spherical room, whether the light bulb's at a high or a low frequency doesn't matter because it's an isotropic radiator. The antenna transmitting pattern on my dipole at 100 megacycles and my dipole at 200 megacycles, they both have the exact same pattern. Either of those dipoles with 100 watts of power in the spherical room is going to give the exact same answer in watts per square meter, whether about 100 megs or 200 megs. So as far as the transmitter is concerned, with a low-gain antenna, nothing changes. Let me drop. What does change is the area of the receiving antenna. The dipole that's doing the receiving, 0.13 lambda squared, happens to be the insertion, has to be the effective capture area of an isotropic antenna. Notice that it's 0.13 lambda squared. If I go to twice the frequency, lambda, the wavelength, is half. Squared is 1/4. The effective capture area of the receiving antenna, when you double the frequency, the effective capture area is 1/4 of it was before. Smaller capture area gets a less signal. I'm now not using a 1 square meter antenna, a 1 square meter of area in the room. I'm only using a 1/4 square meter, and I get a 1/4 of the power, so to speak, if you know what I mean. So it's the change in the area of the receiving antenna that makes the signal get weaker when you go to a higher frequency, and we call that increased free space loss. The free space didn't lose anything. The watts per square meter is the same. You have less square meters on the receiving antenna. We call it free space loss. It creates confusion. That air between you and that receiving antenna is running ice cold under normal circumstances. So that's not where the extra loss is coming from. Let me drop. Now, one of the things that Joe said in his letter, AA2IT, is that when you go to twice the frequency, you get 6 dB of extra loss, so that the, and if you double the distance, it goes up by square law. The receiving area, the free space loss goes up by square law. Double the frequency, you get 1/4 of the receiving signal. Double the distance, you get 1/4 of the signal. So distance is inverse square law. Frequency looks like inverse square law. But there's a couple of catches here. And that is, if I'm keeping the transmitting antenna equal in area, it's a parabolic dish, and it's a 6-foot diameter parabolic dish. And if I double the frequency, the dish gives me 6 dB more gain. Even though doubling the frequency makes the apparent free space loss go up by 6 dB, because my transmitting antenna has 6 more dB of loss, if I keep the dish identical in diameter, and I just go higher in frequency, the reception signal doesn't change, as long as the same receiving antenna has got the same gain on the new frequency. Now, when it comes to distance, if I double the distance, I get 6 dB more loss. If I double the frequency, I get 6 dB more loss. If I half the distance, 6 dB of extra loss comes back. Distance versus frequency is a linear relationship. If I double the frequency, I get 6 dB more loss. If I double the distance, I get 6 dB more loss. See, now, I said something backwards. Okay. People think that you get twice the loss. Yeah, you get 60 dB more loss if I double the distance. I lost the train of thought in which a distance is, I'm trying to remember the way it was expressed in the original letter. Maybe Roy can bring that back to me. It was, in the original letter, it was expressed in such a way that frequency versus distance goes up by square law. Yeah, frequency versus distance goes up by square law. And that's not quite true. AC2GS, I know you would like to ask some comments to this, Roy. Go right ahead. AC2GS, K2IW in the TechNet.
Yes, good evening, Dick. This is AC2GS. How's my signal?
Sounding very good. Audio very slightly lower than mine, but it sounds clean, and maybe you shouldn't raise it as far as dropout is concerned. Over to you, Roy.
Okay, we'll give it a try. One little comment. Saying things that are related linearly and then using decibels, which isn't really a linear relationship, it's a logarithmic relationship, is problematic for me. But I'll read you his question, which I didn't kind of read any specificity you had. Let's see. If there are antennas for 2 meters, 6 meters, 10-meter FM repeaters on a tower at the same height, each one-half wave vertical, each with receivers of equal sensitivity, transmitters of equal power output, which bands will have the greatest range to mobiles in flat terrain? Mobiles also equal antenna, receiver, transmitter power, and why?
And as you said in your answer you gave to Joe, there's a lot of variables involved here. Efficiency and pattern of the antenna on the automobile. Amount of ground reflection versus frequency and distance and terrain. And so I suspect the 6 meters might give greater range than 2 meters, which might give greater range than 432, for instance, is the way quite often people will find the real-world measurements. Is that somewhat similar to what you would see, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW?
Yes, Dick. In my reply to him, I mentioned that on a theoretical path loss basis, it would be 6 meters was the best and 70 centimeters for the worst, but life is complicated, and so it's more difficult to have a mobile and efficient for 6 meters as you can for 2 meters and 70 centimeters, so that in real life experiences where you're not in completely non-terrain, nothing is bouncing against it, and all the antennas are wonderful, it would be a different answer. I kind of thought that probably the sweet spot was around the 2 meter range, given for the reality of the situation.
To a well-equipped 6 meter rig and a well-equipped repeater, I've seen them have very long range compared to 2 meters. But that could also be a function of how many watts, how high was the repeater site, and so on. So there are other variables involved. A 6 meter antenna, if it's working correctly on an automobile, has a considerably larger effective capture area than a 2 meter antenna. It's obviously a bigger antenna. It's a longer whip. And the length of the whip is definitely a function of the area. One of the handy formulas to use is that gain of an antenna equals 4 pi a over lambda squared. Gain, as a hard number, is 4 pi a over lambda squared. Take the log of it if you want it into decibels. You're allowed to take the variables of that equation and move them around. Gain is 4 pi a over lambda squared. You can solve it the other way. Area equals gain lambda squared over 4 pi. Area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. So when you go to a higher frequency, where lambda is going to get smaller, and you're going to square it, and the lambda is on the top of that equation, area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi, obviously twice the frequency, the antenna has 1/4 the capture area. That's if you want to express it in hard numbers, and if you want to do it in logarithm, 1/4 to 1 is a 6 dB loss. So you get 6 dB less, or 1/4 of the effective capture area of an antenna when you double its frequency, if you haven't changed the type of antenna, if it is something like a dipole. Life gets a little bit more complicated if the antenna is a parabolic dish at a microwave frequency. Let me drop it. Because even though you think it's the same antenna, when you go to the higher frequency by changing the feed horn, the parabolic dish, by the way, works at all frequencies. It's only what frequencies it works over is strictly a function of the frequency range of your feed horn that's feeding the dish. Double the frequency, even though you get 6 dB more, one quarter of the 4 times more free space loss, because the fixed diameter parabolic dish at twice the frequency has 4 times more gain. Gain is 4 pi a over lambda squared. You get the 6 dB, or the 4-to-1 ratio of increased gain with the dish when you go to a higher frequency. So therefore, using a dish of fixed diameter, you will think the free space loss didn't change when you went to the higher frequency. And there are people who have done parabolic dish transmissions from a fixed site into a mobile feed horn, into a horn antenna at the car. People have done that on 10 gigs, and they've seen this effect. The most extreme situation of this is where the Voyager spacecraft, let me drop it. Voyager spacecraft is out there at 12 billion miles, 3 times the distance to Pluto. It's a 12-foot diameter dish at 2 gigahertz transmitting that signal back, at 8 gigahertz transmitting the signal back to Earth. And so that signal coming back is like a flashlight beam, if you know what I mean. If they decided to go to a higher frequency, if they had the ability on board to do it, the signal getting back to the Earth would be approximately the same signal strength, even though they doubled the frequency. EC2GS, K2RIW, good, Roy.
Well, yes, I agree with everything you said. Joe's question, though, did mention a halfway vertical. So there are always interesting ways of getting around things, but... I told them on a theoretical basis the answer is 10 meters, but on a practical basis, your value, your results might vary, as they say.
A smart amateur can make a high-efficiency antenna on 6 meters or 2 meters on his automobile. He might even be able to make a high-efficiency antenna on 10 meters on his automobile. So, efficiency of the antenna on the automobile could be constant. As you go to the lower frequencies, you're getting this increased area of the receiving antenna, which shows up as an apparent decrease in the free space loss. So not counting ionospheric effects and ground reflection effects, you might get the greatest range out of 10 meters, out of all those combinations, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Well, perhaps, but also I kind of considered in the back of my head that the longer wavelengths tend to be more less forgiving of objects in their path and undergo reflections and such, where you might be able to get away a little bit the shorter wavelength.
Yeah, that one even is not clear, Roy. As you go to the lower frequencies where the wavelength is larger, get a little bit more of the, what's it now called, the bistatic radar phenomena, or the monostatic. Now, that, maybe I should talk about bistatic. You could transmit a signal directly toward a water tower. This is now a radar transmitter, high-gain parabolic dish antenna, transmitting directly at the center of a water tower 1 mile away. And directly behind that water tower, you've got the receiving site. Common sense would lead you to believe that there's a great big shadow created by the water tower. Well, actually, you perform that experiment, and you may find that if the two are aligned correctly, the transmitting site and the receiving site, the signal to receiving site might be slightly louder with the water tower present than the water tower was not present. There's a kind of fringing effect by which the signal wraps around the side of the water tower and gets retransmitted. So an awful lot of things that you think are a blockage to line of sight with optical frequencies in many cases are not a complete blockage, only a slight attenuator, at RF frequency. Trees, water towers, buildings, and so on. Buildings are sometimes partially transparent, but signals will walk around them. When I was also doing a 10 gigahertz experiment with a guy in eastern New Jersey, he would aim his antenna directly north at the World Trade Center. I would aim my antenna directly west at the World Trade Center. By bouncing off the World Trade Center, we got a stronger signal to us.
Repeater, time out.
We got a stronger signal between us by aiming at the World Trade Center than if we aimed our two dishes directly at each other. So building bounce mode was a very desirable mode at 10 gigs. So radio propagation and bouncing blockage is not clear. There are all kinds of ways that that signal can get there. When you transmit a signal at an RF frequency, every single object in the environment is going to get some of that signal. It's going to bounce off every single thing you got. It's going to take every single one of those millions of paths simultaneously. At the receiving site, it takes every one of those individual paths. Each individual voltage of that signal is added together in a vector manner. That means amplitude and phase are considered when you add them together. In almost every real-world situation except for truly free space, there is always multipath. There's always a million signals going from the transmitter to the receiver. So therefore, in many cases, minor changes in altitude and position of either transmitter or receiver can make a big difference. Let me drop one more. Take a weak repeater that's transmitting into your handy talkie in your living room, and you hold the handy talkie horizontal, vertical. You aim the whip antenna toward the repeater, straight up, to the left, to the right, backwards. You translate the handy talkie in your hand, up, down, left, right, forward, and back. That weak signal you're listening to will come and go. You're listening for the hot spots of both polarization and location. Because of all the multipath that's taking place within your house, within your environment, there are certain positions of that handy talkie rubber duck antenna where those individual bounces all add up in phase, and therefore you'll find a hot spot by moving it around. The hard part to believe is that when you move it around so you hear the strongest signal when you're receiving, and you hold it there and transmit back to the guy, he may not hear you. Because on most repeaters, the transmitting frequency and the receiving frequency are not the same frequency. Therefore, they don't add the same way. So the hot spot for receiving and the hot spot for transmitting, with a bunch of experiments, you'll find out it's two separate hot spots in your living room with that handy talkie. So RF propagation is very different than line of sight when you're shining a flashlight and you've got a wall between you and the receiving site, if you know what I mean. And that wall itself might be 90% transparent toward RF signal. AC2GS, K2RIW, New TechNet.
Yes, I agree, Dick. Light waves operate differently as lower frequency electromagnetic waves. And the description that you had for earlier for the increased amplitude is very reminiscent of gravitational microlensing, where smaller objects very far away curve space around it, and the stars behind them get brighter due to the effect. So it happens even in esoteric stuff like gravitational microlensing. I just thought that it adds a somewhat more important variable to the equation, that position is probably a little bit more important at the lower frequencies than the higher, and this guy's case, again, is a mobile antenna system. So, I could be completely wrong. I have two levels of answer, one that theoretically 10 meters is it, and the other is that other things complicate the situation, so his guess is as best as mine, given a particular situation. There are times that 10 meters probably will be best, and there are probably other times where 10 meters or 6 meters won't quite cut it.
What's kind of interesting, if you're in a long-distance communication to an automobile, and you're first doing the experiment on 6 meters, then 2 meters, then 432, Because as you drive along with your automobile, you're going to hear what some people call the picket fence effect. In other words, you hear the signal coming and going, going up and down in amplitude. Let's call it the fade rate as you're driving. As you go to the higher frequencies, the fade rate gets faster. You'll hear a flutter much faster at 450 megahertz than you will at 2 meters, than you will at 6 meters. Want to really hear a high flutter rate, go to 10 gigahertz with an automobile. The flutter rate becomes so fast it becomes a tone. You literally hear a tone because of the flutter rate with a moving automobile at 10 gigahertz. You'll hear a pitch. So in all of those frequencies, you're going to hear peaks and valleys as you go in phase and out of phase between the ground reflection and the direct signal as you move along, and maybe reflections off of other objects that are nearby. It doesn't mean that the peak and valley gets stronger or weaker versus the frequency you're on. It's just that as you move along, because of the shorter wavelength at the higher frequency, you'll be in phase and out of phase faster at the higher frequency. So, once again, what's the ideal frequency to be used? Part of the variables involved are how busy is the band, how much time will you get a chance to use it, is there a good repeater site nearby that's on that band? Let me drop. So not all of your answers are going to be an RF answer. Some of it's going to be how many repeaters are on 6 meters versus 450 versus 2 meters. 2 meters has a lot more repeaters that are active. And you've got a whole lot of apparent repeaters on 450, but you go on there and announce your call letters and you might not get an answer, because there's not as many people monitoring to give you an answer as you drive through a community. You can be taking a long trip with your automobile, and you may get a lot more answers on 2 meters than 450, even though there may be more 450 repeaters in that particular town. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Quite true, Dick. You know, I have my little pan adapter so I can see activity. And it's very rare that you see, than say, 3 repeater conversations simultaneously on VHF. On UHF, you get this full sense that there's a lot of activity. But when I tune to these things, I realize that there's about 5 or 6 DMR stations that are linked to each other, and you're basically hearing the linked simultaneous signals from all of them. So, yeah, there's more repeater units in the UHF from my noticing, but kind of spreads out and more difficult, whereas VHF, you have only a few prime repeaters around that people regularly scan for and respond to. So I would agree. But in addition, I mean, as you go up in frequency, though, there's a degree of radio frequency transparency. You get up to 40 centimeters, and those things can go through a couple of inches of brick and such that aren't going to happen on 10 meters or 6 meters. So, again, it's very, very complicated. You could come up with almost an answer, and sometimes you'll be right, and sometimes you'll be wrong.
Therefore, Roy, a new ham getting onto ham radio might desire to do a research as to radio-wise, what's the best frequency to put into my automobile in what order? Do I go to 6 meters first, 2 meters first, 450 first, 10 meters first? To get the maximum amount of enjoyment out of it, might use a different set of variables for the criteria. How many of your close friends are on that band? How many repeaters on that band are within reasonable range of your house? That might be a bigger deciding factor. You'd like to talk to those particular friends. You got a bunch of friends in your particular club that are all on 2 meters. Even if 2 meters is not the most ideal frequency as far as range is concerned to your automobile, you might choose to put 2 meters in there first so you can talk to those people while you're on the way to work in the morning and you're going through a great big traffic jam. And by talking to these people, it'll calm you down as opposed to getting angry with the fact that none of the automobiles are moving on the expressway. So there are a lot of people who get quite a bit of enjoyment out of 2 meters that way. They can discuss how bad the traffic is and discuss what the weather is and what they intend to do on their next vacation while they're stuck in traffic, but they're on a band that most of their friends are on. So I think that's a bigger variable than the radio propagation variable, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW.
I agree entirely, Dick, but unfortunately, ham radio has become even more granular these days. Not only do you have to concern yourself with what band you want to be on, and most people buy a multi-band mobile or a handy talkie, so they're doing at least 2 meters and 70 centimeters, and occasionally 220 as well. But nowadays, you have to deal with digital technologies that are not compatible. If your friends are into Fusion from Yaesu, then you're really not interested or shouldn't be that interested in DMR or D-Star, and vice versa. So it's become more fragmented, unfortunately, not more inclusive over time.
In your particular case, in your particular location, Roy, if you were getting on ham radio for the first time and you were about to equip your automobile, what frequency and what mode do you think you would choose right now? Over to you, Roy.
I never cease to be amazed by guys who lug enormous base stations into their cars and they do 80 meters and 40 meters, but I don't think that's terribly conducive for the average person. I tend to recommend people get a two-band, 2 meter, 70 centimeter FM radio. And again, I ask them, they know that they have friends who like Fusion or DMR or D-Star, then to decide whether to buy an ICOM or a Yaesu or a Chinese brand. But I think you can't go wrong with a regular FM analog 2 meter, 70 centimeter radio for a car. And that's what I think about 95% of the people in the metropolitan area who have a radio, a ham radio in their car, usually default to.
I agree with you quite strongly, Roy, for a number of reasons. That two-band FM 2 meter 450 rig is nice and compact. It might even squeeze right onto the dashboard almost. The antenna is not huge. And you're talking to your local people from your automobile. It is more fun to talk day-to-day with the people you know well who live in your county, in your vicinity. And you can discuss the weather, traffic, and whatever. A 80 to 10 meter HF rig is usually quite a bit more bulky. The antenna is quite a bit larger. You tend to have QSOs at a much longer distance when the ionosphere is supporting that. Today you'll talk to somebody in Chicago, and tomorrow you'll talk to somebody in South Carolina. But you won't hear the South Carolina guy again tomorrow. You know what I mean? You don't get a chance to, in many cases, form a close relationship with him. The local people you'd like to talk to are really VHF, UHF. So doing that first, get more bang for the dollar and a lot more people you can talk to who you're interested in. In the beginning, it's interesting. Let me drop. With an HF rig in the automobile, it is interesting to say that, hey, I'm talking to somebody 800 miles away. But only once in a while is the band open in that direction. And those tend to be, hello, goodbye, I'm using a so-and-so rig, please QSL. Whereas you talk on your VHF, UHF frequencies to your local people, you get into a real conversation where you're picking each other's brains, talking about a real subject. HF QSOs, real rag chewing on HF is much more difficult. There's a tremendous amount of QR Mary, QR Nancy, fading ionospheric conditions, and so on. Nowhere near as pleasant. And a terrible signal-to-noise ratio most of the time of a sideband signal. With FM, you're hearing high-fidelity audio continuously per se of people who you know and love, who live in your county and maybe in your town or the adjacent towns. So the VHF gives you a lot more bang for the, a lot more pleasure for the dollar. AC2GS, K2RIW, that's a bunch of opinions. Your mileage may vary.
2 Bravo Zulu with a comment.
Yes, Rich recognized. What do you have to say, Rich?
Roy, you told me that you read something or received a letter or whatever from a guy who talked about the sunspot cycle how, you know, low it is and may never come back. Maybe you could talk about that too, but I really do think that the propagation, the HF propagation, or lack thereof, or the poor propagation is driving a lot of people to VHF and UHF.
Yeah, Rich brings up a very interesting point. We're now near the bottom of a sunspot cycle. That makes HF from the automobile, or even HF from the home, a little bit, quite a bit less enjoyable. Over to you, Roy.
Well, it depends on your band. If you're a big, 160 or 80 meter guy, then none of this really touches you much, except when we had that geomagnetic storm recently. It's 20 meters and up that's blown to smithereens. But we had a guy here on TechNet who was very upset that he wasn't receiving anything anywhere, and he wasn't blaming it on his antenna. He was blaming it on the propagation in the world. I had a guy, I do a 10-meter net Sunday morning, and it was very sad. The guy was telling me that he's been in the hobby for 50 years, and this is the worst he's ever seen it. And he's almost gone into a depression where he told me that he truly believes there will not be a sunspot cycle for the next 11 years, that it went down and it's going to stay down until after he's passed away. So he's seriously considering selling all of his equipment, and it's sad beyond belief to hear that. I sent him a copy of that sunspot cycle that I pulled out of Scientific American. I hope it helps him kind of get over this depression, but it's very upsetting. But again, there's still 160, there's still 80 meters, 40 is halfway decent, and 40 has East Car, which is mostly mobile 40-meter guys talking to each other. Richie N2EO likes to show up on East Car. It's very popular, and it works for them.
2RQ mobile.
RQ recognized. What'd you like to say?
I was going to say that concerning the HF propagation, or lack thereof, as you put it, Roy, I think the movement is encouraging people to do more digital. The phone is frustrating, but some of the digital modes are incredibly robust. We did a mini field day in September in Levittown, and we were making contact on 20 meters, and I went to 40 meters and tried PSK-31. I couldn't see a signal much on the waterfall, but I found somebody on Olivia. We were having a rag chew, and he was in Louisiana, running 20 watts.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, well, I just want to take a minute to make an announcement in case somebody would like to see one of these rockets that we talk about take off and actually land back on the ground, which will be happening in, let's see, a little over 21 minutes from now. I can give them the website. You guys can keep talking. If they want to put that on in the background, they'll get to see it live. Take off from, California, put a satellite in the space, and then eight minutes later, it's gonna come back and land on back where it started from in California. First time they're gonna do it, where it's gonna land on land like they do in Florida. But it's a first for them. So if I can give out that website, somebody wants to put it on in the background. Back to you, Roy.
I think you should give out that website, Paul. Go right ahead.
Okay, it's very easy. www.spacex.com/webcast. www.spacex.com/webcast. And they just came on right now. They're just showing their preview, and I guess about 10 minutes or maybe about 10 minutes from that, they'll come on and they'll talk a little bit before the launch, and
they go through that. It's their own, you can't get this through NASA. It's private. It's SpaceX website. Back to you, Dick.
You got it, Roy.
Yes, very good, Paul. Thank you very much. Lou, I like digital technology and the latest and greatest digital data modes. I find, though, the latest and greatest to be a wee bit sterile. Things like FT8 are practically designed not to exchange any human interaction whatsoever. It's ID, signal strength, and a few other little variables, and then you're off to the next guy. So although people enjoy it, and I say, great, if you're having fun with it, go with it, it kind of saddens me. As you mentioned, your experience with digital data is I like to exchange ideas and opinions and concepts with people. And a lot of the digital modes are kind of soft on that aspect.
I agree with you entirely. But as I said, I've been very impressed with some of the more robust ones, Livia being one of them. I had experience on a net, told this story to a number of people. I knew what frequency the net was on, what time, and I was there. I could not see the signal on the waterfall. I could not hear it on the speaker, and I was getting 100% copy from net control, then to RQ. Back to you, Roy.
Well, yeah, it's sort of amazing what a low symbol rate can accomplish, especially when you sprinkle a little bit of forward error correction on top of it. It's sort of amazing that I look at my PAN adapter and I don't see much, but I pull out FT8 or I pull out some of the other modes, and sure enough, there are people chatting away. Again, a lot of it is very, very, very simple chatting, but I'm glad that you found a guy that you could actually exchange talk with. I mean, you know, some of these guys, they don't like typing, and to them it's like using a typewriter. So you get a cultural problem as well. Yes, Rich.
I've said this many times before, but I can't get past sending that sending signals over the internet, no matter what mode, no anything that. Putting a signal on the internet is nowhere near like what I'm doing in the last 2 days, trying to put up a little, you know, well, now it's a tall, 2-meter vertical, and all the variations and all the different configurations and how I can do it and the fun of doing it and then coming back into the shack to see how, you know, how it works has been an excitement for me for 58 years. So anything that doesn't go into the air from a ham radio, I just can't see that it's anywhere near what we've been doing for all these years.
Well, Rich, I mean, Lou is talking about Olivia, he's talking about PSK, I was talking about FT8. They're all digital, but they have with the internet, they're simply quadrature sampled modulation, I think, on radio frequency. It's pure RF. If you have no antenna, you can't do Olivia, you can't do PSK, and you can't do FT8.
Yeah, no, I understand that. But, you know, Echolink and there's a lot of other stuff I think out there that does use IP, voice over IP, and you know, tonight on the net, somebody was on Echolink, and that's fine, that's great. But the thrill of putting up a little wire antenna, a little 2-meter vertical like I am, and not knowing if I really do need to run the coax out of that, you know, from those two elements at 90 degrees and all that to me, I mean, it's just, I don't know. I have a hard time with voice over IP and ham radio, but I'm probably wrong, and that's just my opinion. W2BZ, Roy.
I understand, Rich, and you're free to have that opinion. I mean, I have a more generalized concept that any port in the storm, if that's the way you can get in, then that's the only way you can get in.